session number 28898, reel 2.
Max Charles with reel 2. With the Tiger Moth, how would you taxi the aircraft?
There were no brakes on the Tiger Moth, so you taxied it very gingerly. You know, aircraft tend to wind sock. They tend to want to go into the wind for the streamline. And so you've got to taxi very carefully using rudder, and just be very, very gentle. Just a little burst of throttle. Because if you had no brakes, you couldn't. You know, you just had to hope that you're going in the right direction.
And what kind of pre-flight checks would you do with the aircraft? What would you look for?
A Tiger Moth. Controls. I mean, you walk around the aircraft. You check there are no leaks coming from under the engine. You just check the air screw for looseness. And okay. Then you check the ailerons, that they were moving freely. You check the pitot head cover was removed. That's the thing that gives you how fast you're going. Air dashing into this pitot tube shows you how fast you're going. So you take the cover off that. And you just walk around the aircraft and check for any obvious signs of things being misplaced or little lock has not been properly closed. Then you go to the rear of the aircraft, check the elevators going up and down okay and going in unison, check the rudder was moving freely. And that was it, really. It was just a visual check. And
how would you take the aircraft off? What's the process of taking the aircraft off?
Well, you taxi to the upwind part of the airfield. No, the downwind part of the aircraft field. Then you taxi across wind, so you're looking both ways, because a flying training aircraft landing and taking off the whole time. And you make sure that no one's coming in to land on top of you, and then you turn into wind. There's windsock, goes all around there, the windsock. Turn into wind by looking at the windsock. Or just gauging it in a strong wind. So you couldn't fly in too strong a wind in a Tiger Moth, but and then you would just check. I think we had an oil pressure gauge. I'm not sure. I did very few instrument checks. I think we did in a Tiger Moth. But then you just open the throttle wide. Got it up off. Got the tail off the ground as quickly as you could by pushing the stick forward, and then it started to bounce. And then you got up to about 45 knots, and you just eased back on the stick, and it got airborne. And you just climbed away full throttle till you got to where you wanted, and you just throttled back to the cruising throttle setting.
How do you land it? What do you have to do to land an aircraft?
To land a Tiger Moth. It was easy approaching the airfield. You just throttle back and you just go into a wide curve, make sure nothing's coming in, make sure the aircraft's clear, make sure you've got into wind. You're doing it into wind, of course. Very, very, very necessary with a light aircraft like a Tiger Moth to land into wind, take off into wind. Because what you don't want to do is land like that and have your undercut ripped off. So, land sideways, you know, sort of drift sideways and have your. So you've got to be into wind. And you sort of glide and touch your throttle to make sure you're aiming for the right spot on the point where you want to land, just over the hedge. And then when you've got there, you throttle fully back and you pull the stick back and you keep pulling the stick back. And you literally stall the aircraft onto the ground. You make sure it's run out of flying speed and it's about to stall. And if you were up in the air, it would stall, it would just go down like that. But when it's got to that point, it just touches down. If you haven't got the stick exactly right, you land on the wheels first, you could bounce, and then you've got a problem of getting the tail back again. And next to the Spitfire, the Tiger Moth was the hardest aircraft to land. You couldn't do much damage going so slowly, but to get it to do a three-pointer, that's main wheels and tail wheel landing at the same time, which is ideal, was a bit. You had to get used to that.
And how can you judge your height to where you want?
Just visually. That's all visual. You enter the circuit at about 1,000 feet, the circuit of the airfield. You go downwind at about 1,000 feet. Then you start your curve turn in, losing height the whole way. And you just have to judge it. You can see that you're not going above the point where you'd want to land. You're not going below it. And so you keep on the point where you want to land, and you just keep the power and nose up a bit, nose down a bit, but off, power off, and you aim for that point. And when you've got to that point, you've reduced speed quite a bit, of course, on the inward leg to land. And then as soon as you're over there, you cut the throttle altogether and get it down as quickly as you can.
Had you received any instructions as to what to do should you have had, say, an engine failure during takeoff?
Oh, yes, we had. We just looked for the nearest field and nearest big field that would take you. So all the time you're flying in a Tiger Moth, actually, you've got your eyes open for a field. Because if the engine cuts, then you've got to take some fairly rapid action. And you've got to head for this field and hope that you judge it right and can land in it properly.
And what kind of obstacles would you be looking for?
High trees, telephone, electric cable, electric wires, hills, don't land on a hill, bumpiness of the field. You have a field of wheat, for example, you've got a grass field. A similar flat surface to the airfield you land on, hopefully as big as, and sufficient to get your landing run in, to get to the far end without hitting the far end.
And with the Tiger Moth,
you practice that. You do practice. The instructor would suddenly close the throttle on you and say, right, we've got a total engine failure, land the aircraft. And you fire at travel. When you've got just about down there, you have the throttle again, fly away. So, yes, you'd have made that, or you wouldn't have made it.
What type of heights were you flying with when you were doing this early
Tiger Moth, you never went any higher than. I really can't remember, but certainly higher than 5,000 feet.
And when you did the cross countries,
it's visual map reading. It's visual map reading. It's her map. Well, you plotted it first. We had quite a useful navigational aid. I forgot what it used to call it now. It had a sort of compass base on it and a drift on it and all the rest of it. And if there was a wind, you work that out and you put that on it and you put the course you wanted to steer. And you just wrote all this down and then you just did it. And you made sure that you're on track because you could see on your map, well, there's a church there and there's a little town there and a railway there. And that's what we're going to go between. I'm drawing a line between those on the map. So if you're off to one side of it, you just adjust by a few degrees. It's just map reading, really. You plan it first of all on a map. And then you keep checking the course you should be on by whether you've left or right of your course. But I found navigation very interesting. I used to enjoy that.
Was there anything else on this?
Tiger Moth, really, no. That was just a very preliminary part of your training. You soon forget that and get it behind you.
Was there a failure rate on the course at that stage?
Oh, yes. The failure rate on every course. I don't know what the failure rate was on Tiger Moth, but oh, and also on Tiger Moth, they decided to stream you. They picked the fighter pilots from the bomber pilots. I don't know how they gauge it, I suppose the way you handle the aircraft, but to the coastal command pilots, to the transport command pilots, and so on. And fortunately, I wanted to be a fighter pilot, the way to go. And fortunately, I was picked to be a fighter, to go in the fighter pilot stream, which meant that I went to a flying training school, which is advanced flying training, 5FTS at somewhere near Cramwell. I can't remember it now, but it's up somewhere near Cramwell. north of the Reek in that big hill. We flew Masters, which were low-wing monoplanes, with a most unfortunate engine. There were rebuilt Eagle engines, Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, taken from old Hawk Hearts and Hawker Furies, that were biplanes, pre-war aircraft. And they were subject to failure, unfortunately. But that, again, is a very different experience. You're in a fairly powerful aeroplane now. It was a monoplane, quite a bit of power, and the instructor sat at the back to begin with. And well, it was very different because you had a powerful roar of the engine, and you're away, and everything went much quicker.
Do monoplanes behave more differently from biplanes?
Not basically, no. They're just more streamlined, and there's less drag. But as you get faster in an aircraft, the controls become more sensitive, and everything's happening more quickly. But unfortunately, at 5 FTS, we had a period where we had so many engine failures and killed pilots through engine failure on takeoff. They just flew into the ground. That they closed the whole school down for a week to sort out what had happened to the engines. And there was these reconditioned Eagle engines which just weren't performing. So eventually they made this, it's called a Miles Master, that aircraft, Miles Master. Eventually they put a radial engine in them, which was much better. But I flew the one with the inline Eagle engine in it, Rolls-Royce Eagle engine. And you just did more advanced, there you started to learn to fly instruments. Fly a flying cloud, fly at night, the first night flying there, which is frightening. Because you take off and you're suddenly in the black. No visual, they see odds, but you couldn't see lights on the ground because it was blackout. You couldn't see anything. I think there was a red light on top of the Reek. I don't think that was there, that's why people flew into it. A lot of pilots flew into the Reek and killed themselves. Just a great big rock, do you know it? A rock sticking out of the ground. Big hill sticking out of the ground, which is due south on the takeoff path of the aircraft. But yes, there we started to learn to fly instruments, and that was when you were flying instruments. That's tricky because you've got no visual when you're flying like what's called VFR, visual flight rules, where you can see where you're going. You can see the horizon, see trees, houses, everything, clouds, sky, and land. You keep it straight. At night time, you have no horizon. You can't see where you are. It's black. You could be in a fishbowl. So you've got to fly on your instruments, and you've got to believe them. And people get disorientated. And lots of pilots, young pilots, kill themselves because they didn't believe their instruments. They thought they were flying like this on one side, but in fact they weren't, so they overcorrect. And in fact, then they put themselves on the side and they start to go down. Then they get panicky and they start to go, why am I going down? I pull the nose back, and they get into, that's suicide. So you've got to be very determined to just keep your head in the box and watch the instrument, fly on instrument, ignore how you feel, and you're going to be disorientated anyway because the aircraft bumping through bumpy air. And you just got to just watch those instruments and fly on the instrument. Don't take any notice of outside influences at all.
Is that quite unnatural?
Totally. It's totally unnatural. It's a flying on instruments, in particularly in rough weather, and particularly in cloud, is a very demanding experience. If you haven't got an automatic pilot and you've got a fairly light aircraft, the faster the aircraft, the better it is because it's more stable. You can correct it just gently when you're bumping about in a lighter aircraft. Yes, that's the biggest jump in flying, is flying from what we call VFR, visual flight rules, to IFR, instrument flight rules. That's flying at night or in cloud. And that the jump from learning to fly an aircraft under visual flight rules conditions is one thing. Getting into cloud or night flying is a totally different experience.
How did they introduce you to that kind of flying?
You have an instructor in the back, he takes you up. And he says, you know, this is how you do it. This, you've got an artificial horizon there, you've got a turn and bank indicator, you've got an altimeter. There's a panel which is sort of standard in all military aircraft in Britain, which had a rotating compass. It wasn't actually a compass, but you set that to be a compass, but in the centre at the bottom. Artificial horizon above it. On the left-hand side was your airspeed indicator, I think. Maybe an altimeter, I can't remember. On the right-hand side, airspeed indicator or altimeter. And a turn and bank in the instrument, which is not very useful for anything. And a rate of climb and descent instrument. So you have those five instruments, which you flew on, which could tell you how fast you're climbing, how level your wings were, or whether your nose was down or up. Told you everything you wanted to know, but you had to do it from these instruments. And it could be very disorientating. You could feel sometimes that you were banking when you weren't. Now, if you went by how you felt, that was death, because you'd slowly go over and down you'd go. So you really had to keep stuck into these instruments and not be put off by how you felt. And sometimes very demanding. It was tiring, very tiring flying.
In the Master, was there some form of hood that you could pull off?
That had a hood. And the instructor at the back, he got in, he had a hood that was level, but he pulled a lever and he pulled his seat up and pulled a sort of plastic screen up in front of him. So he's looking over your head. And he was out in the fresh air a little bit, because he had this hood that came around here at an angle like that, just going over his head, and it pulled at you, and it pulled himself up. So he was sitting looking over your head. But for instrument flying, he wanted to be down. He just pulled a couple of cockpit down, and he's watching very carefully. So he'd look out the horizon, keep it straight, just like basic flying again. But the instructors are on to you the whole time. It's always tense with the instructor flying with you, because they really were hard.
Where did most of the instructors come from?
In those days were pre-war pilots. They've been in the RAF for some time. Some of them are a bit too elderly, perhaps, for combat. And of course they had to have instructors, so they had to select people to instruct. But mine on the Tiger Moth, he was a sergeant fellow, he was very good, but he'd been in the RAF for quite a while, I think, before the war. But he was getting on. I mean, I was just barely 18 then, and he was, I suppose he must have been about 40-ish, but he was a very good pilot, extremely good pilot. So instructors were generally, that stage, they were sort of older men who'd flown before.
And did the Master have any other vices, other than obviously there was a problem with the engines, were there any vices in how it handled?
No, it was handled quite well. It was a nice airplane to handle, but it just had this, you're always conscious of the fact that the engine would suddenly seize. It used to seize suddenly. And of course, the heavier the aircraft is, the more they could go. Tiger Moth had quite a shallow glide angle, but a Master, being a heavier aircraft, the engine seized, you couldn't glide very far. It used to go down rather steeply, and you didn't have much time to pick somewhere to land. So the best thing to do would be to get out, bail out.
Did you get any instruction on bailing out, on ground instruction at that stage?
Yes, we did. We got quite a bit. We just get instructions on how to fold a parachute. In fact, we had to fold our own parachutes so that we knew they were safe. And that was quite a technique in itself, getting it packed up and then folded up and into the thing, getting the pin in and the straps right. But if you did it yourself, then you were responsible for it, and if it didn't work, you had no one else to blame. So yes, you had a lot of work, and I had to get out too. Each aircraft had its own way of bailing out till the ejector seat came. Spitfire and Hurricanes, best thing is to roll onto your back and drop out. you could climb over the side in a Hurricane and a Spitfire. Later on in Vampire, you couldn't. You had a tail that might cut you in half if you tried to just jump out. You had to drop out of that one upside down.
What about the Master? What would you have done in the Master?
You just climb over the side. I don't know if you can eject the hood or not, or whether you can just pull it back on rails. That's right. And just climb over the side and jump down.
What about yourself at this time? Were you growing confident in your flying skills?
Yes, because I was always one of the earliest ones to go solo at flying school, so I thought, well, I must be doing something right. You're always tense, you know, you're always wound up, hoping you're doing the right thing, hoping nothing goes wrong, hoping your engine keeps going. When you're in the air at that stage, you're always sort of fairly sort of tense.
And with pilots at that stage as well, you know, obviously you soared quite quickly. Is that something to do with how you've dealt with the aircraft? And some people never really get that sensation?
Well, I always had a good coordination. I had a good spatial awareness. I was a very keen formation flyer. I could get tucked in within a foot of another person's wing quite comfortably. I formed my own aerobatic team on Vampires. So I had a good spatial awareness and good coordination, and I think that helped me quite a bit.
And were there some people who just never seemed to get?
Some people could never land an aeroplane. Most of them failed in Tiger Moth because they couldn't land it. Could bounce around the place and give them several shots at it, but then there's a no. You get a dropout rate on each one. Masters, for example, some people couldn't do instrument flying, they couldn't take it. And those who hadn't done it, they just didn't want to do it.
So there are almost different levels that people can reach, and that's their point of...
Yes. Every course you do is a dropout rate. Now, those people that weren't going, were going on to transport aircraft or bomber aircraft, instead of going into a flying training school with masters, they went to a flying training school with Oxfords. That's a twin engine piston aircraft. Quite nice to fly. I've flown them often. But they went that way because that's a dual engine thing and it was no aerobatics. And, you know, they were going to do aerobatics in the Lancaster, for example, so they didn't have to bother to learn how to do it.
And was there a feeling amongst your fellow students at that stage that you wanted to be... Did most people want to be fighter pilots, or did they just want to fly?
Well, some didn't want to be there. I think some chose bombers or transport command, yeah, so aiming that way. I think most really secretly wanted to be fighter pilots. But then again, you see, some didn't like aerobatics. Once they did aerobatics, they said, oh, I'll cry. Don't like this being upside down bit and twirling around. I'd rather fly more steadily.
Did you do aerobatics in the Master?
Oh, yeah. It was quite a good aerobatic aeroplane. It could have used a bit more power with the Eagle. The engine Eagle wasn't really all that powerful. It became a very fine aircraft when it had its radial engine. I never flew one of those. But, yes, I did. No, I didn't. I didn't.
What aerobatics would you do?
Oh, your famous bow roll. You see, a bow roll is a lazy roll. You've got positive G on the whole way round. You've got negative G, and you go in a big up and over and down like that. You've got positive G on. A real roll, which we used to try to do, is to keep it on the same axis the whole time. Now, you've got to get, as you're going over, you've got to put top rudder on to keep the nose up, or it'll drop. Then, as you're getting further over, you put a stick forward to keep the nose up. And you get over that way, you have to put this rudder on again, top rudder, you know. And as you get up, coming the right way up, you pull the stick back to keep the nose up. So that's the perfect roll, to keep on the same axis and go around that way. But I mean, a bow roll is so simple and so easy to do. It's the easiest aerobatic manoeuvre to do.
Did you loop the Master at all?
Yes, looped it. Roll off the top.
How do you loop it?
Well, you've got to have enough speed, first of all. And you were told what speed is. So you get this speed on. Then you just pull back, and you keep pulling back, full throttle. And you hold the stick hard back until you're looking back over here. And suddenly, the horizon appears upside down, of course. You keep going until it slowly slips down this way. Normal sky comes. And then, when you're going level, you just pull out.
Did you enjoy the acrobatics?
Yes, I enjoyed the acrobatics. Yes, I did, particularly later on in jets, particularly.
Did you do any formation flying with the Masters at this stage?
I can't remember. I really can't remember that. I probably did, but I can't remember.
And at that stage, how much of your time was divided between the instructor and time that you would spend on your own? Because would the instructor just purely take you for, say...
I suppose probably two-thirds or one-third. Two-thirds on your own, one-third instructor. I should think that's about it, balance.
And that was, again, just to... Were you encouraged to hone your own skills at that stage?
Yes, you're sent off on exercises. You had exercise four, which may be height climb, or it might be aerobatics, or it might be spinning, or it might be soaring. They all had a number. Okay, Charles, was coming. Today I want you to go do exercise four and five. And they were particular exercises that you had to do. Four might be stalling, five might be aerobatics.
And at that stage, is there any type of weather that you wouldn't fly in?
Oh, yes, there's always a limit. And it's fairly high when you're being instructed. It's fairly high cloud and reasonable visibility. But, yes, there is.
Apart from the problems with the engines, were there any other accidents on the course at all during that period?
Well, there are always accidents flying. I mean, when you're training, there are accidents. People do get killed all the time. More on Masters than on any aircraft I flew in training, and that was mainly the engine seizing and the chap probably not bailing out properly or not finding a field to land in because he wasn't experienced.
And did they use them when pilots were flying solo rather than with the instructor, or was there accidents that occurred?
I suppose it must have happened with instructors, and I can't just remember that, but I know we lost quite a few at High Erkel. Field called High Erkel. Yes. Not as many with instructors because, first of all, you weren't flying with them as often as you were flying by yourself. And secondly, chaps became disoriented at night when they were on a night exercise on their own and probably hit a hill, flew into the ground or something or whatever.
And at the end of the course, is there a final examination?
There's a written examination, and you are taken up by the chief flying instructor, who puts you through the whole thing. All the things you've learnt, he says, right, now do so-and-so, now do so-and-so, now do so-and-so, and he assesses you. He says, right, you pass.
And at that point, is that the point that you receive your wings as such?
Well, in fact, towards the end of FTS, AFTS really should be called, Advanced Flying Training School, there were about 40 of us on my particular course. And the fellow came up to me, one of the officers came up to me and said, we're transferring you to the officer's mess. Right, very kind. Then you've got to wear this little white flash in your hat. And several of us were picked out to become commissioned. I don't know what, we didn't know it. We didn't know this at all. And I suppose about, out of the 40 on our FTS course, I suppose about 7 or 8 were picked out to go to the officer's mess, which was very, very different from the airman's mess we'd been in. We had to mind our P's and Q's, hold our knives and forks properly. But then we thought, oh, we're going to be And I do hand it to the RAF. I mean, there's always a flight sergeant on the gate, nearly always a hoary old chap who's been in the RAF for donkey's years. And when he went out as airman, before we were sent to the officer's mess, he'd say, lad, come here. What's that about? Put that straight. Get your tie straight. Bloody nuisance. Get what those bloody boots. Get, you know, really give you dressing now. Turn around. Yeah, pull them jacket down and get yourself. Now you can behave yourself. Off you go. Now, as soon as you went to the officer's mess, you had a white, and you were commissioned, rather, you'd walk by that same flight sergeant, and he'd go, sir, it changes character altogether. And that was the beauty of them.